The year was 1974, and an unlikely meeting was taking place between physicists Fred Allen Wolf and Jack Sarfatti with Werner Erhard, the charismatic founder of the EST movement. Despite Sarfatti bluntly calling Erhard an asshole at their first encounter, Erhard embraced him and promised funding. Soon, thousands of dollars flowed to support quantum physics research from this eager new patron. This unusual alliance would help spark a scientific renaissance that would transform our understanding of reality itself and eventually lead to technologies we use today. In an era when conventional physics had become dominated by a shut-up-and-calculate mentality, a ragtag group of physicists, many unemployed due to the post-Apollo job crash, formed the Fundamental Physics Group in Berkeley. They dared to ask the philosophical questions their mentors had abandoned. Their explorations of quantum weirdness, consciousness, and even parapsychology would eventually lead to the development of quantum encryption and computing, technologies now considered essential to our digital future. The founders of quantum mechanics weren't just brilliant mathematicians, they were philosophers grappling with profound questions about reality. Niels Bohr adopted the yin-yang symbol on his coat of arms to represent his principle of complementarity. The idea that quantum objects require seemingly contradictory descriptions like particles and waves. This Eastern influence perspective helped him articulate the Copenhagen interpretation, which remains influential today. Erwin Schrödinger studied Eastern mysticism extensively, particularly the Upanishads, and developed his famous cat paradox to illustrate quantum absurdity. His thought experiment of a cat simultaneously alive and dead became the quintessential illustration of quantum superposition. Even Einstein, though critical of quantum theory, engaged deeply with its philosophical implications, famously objecting to what he called spooky action at a distance and maintaining that God does not play dice with the universe. These pioneers formed an intimate intellectual circle. About a dozen physicists surrounded by only a few dozen more worldwide contributors during the mid-1920s. They constantly exchanged visits at centers like Boris Copenhagen Institute, traveling across Europe for discussions lasting days or months. Werner Heisenberg would spend weeks at Bohr's Institute, taking long walks to debate uncertainty principles. Wolfgang Pauli and Paul Dirac regularly joined these gatherings, contributing their own philosophical perspectives. Their extensive correspondence, tens of thousands of preserved letters, reveals their daily struggle to interpret the strange new quantum formalism. These letters show how concepts like wave-particle duality and quantum entanglement emerged from intense philosophical debates. This philosophical impulse shaped their teaching methodology profoundly. Early quantum textbooks included entire chapters on quantum mechanics and philosophy, or paused to discuss implications for Kantian philosophy and scientific objectivity. Max Born's textbooks explicitly addressed epistemological questions about measurement and reality. Graduate examinations routinely required essays on wave-particle duality and interpretive matters, with students expected to engage with both mathematical and philosophical aspects of quantum theory. The physics curriculum of the 1930s treated philosophical understanding as essential to mastering quantum mechanics. The landscape changed dramatically after World War II, reflecting broader shifts in scientific culture. Einstein lamented his colleagues' new ardent lack of interest in philosophy, seeing it as a departure from the field's intellectual roots. Caltech graduate students complained that their preparation on paradoxes and queer logical points proved useless in exams that now focused solely on calculations. Essay questions disappeared nationwide, replaced by standard calculation problems that emphasized practical applications over conceptual understanding. Textbook reviewers began praising books that avoided philosophical discussion rather than engaging with it, marking a significant shift toward a more pragmatic, calculation-focused approach to quantum physics education. This transformation reflected the growing emphasis on practical applications and technological development in the post-war era, though some argue it came at the cost of deeper theoretical understanding. The philosophical decline in quantum physics resulted from several historical forces. fascism had scattered the European physics community, with nearly 100 physicists and mathematicians following Einstein to America during the 1930s. The close-knit community that once traveled freely across Europe for spontaneous discussions had been permanently dispersed. More significantly, World War II transformed physicists' working methods. Recruited for military projects like radar, proximity fuses, rockets, and the atomic bomb, physicists were thrust into practical gadgetry alongside engineers and military planners. The wartime pressure to produce functional devices left no time for philosophical contemplation. They learned to focus solely on extracting numerical results as efficiently as possible. The Cold War hardened these patterns as defense agencies became the dominant funding source for physics. Though only a minority worked directly on weapons, virtually all academic physicists were enlisted in a massive project, producing more physicists at an ever-increasing rate to maintain America's technical workforce. Policymakers openly describe physicists as a standing army, a war commodity, and a major war asset to be stockpiled and rationed. This mindset intensified after Sputnik in 1957, when Congress allocated another $1 billion to support graduate training in defense fields. Physics enrollments exploded faster than any other field. By the Korean War, American physics departments were producing 3 times as many PhDs as pre-war highs, a number that would triple again after Sputnik. This astronomical growth transformed teaching conditions. Introductory quantum mechanics courses swelled to over 100 students, destroying the pre-war intimacy between faculty and students. Faced with overwhelming enrollments, physics professors across America revamped their teaching style to accommodate high-throughput pedagogy. The first casualty was discussion-based, qualitative philosophical inquiry into what quantum mechanics actually meant. Looking out at stadium-sized classrooms, instructors felt they had little choice but to focus on calculational aspects that could be easily taught and tested. Into this intellectually sterile landscape stepped John Bell, a physicist at CERN who had long harbored private doubts about quantum mechanics. While acknowledging quantum mechanics worked for all practical purposes, FAP, he wondered whether it offered a coherent description of nature beyond mere calculation. Bell was particularly troubled by the Copenhagen interpretation's emphasis on measurement and observers, feeling it dodged fundamental questions about physical reality. Bell's thoughts returned to Einstein's famous EPR thought experiment from 1935. Einstein and colleagues had argued that quantum mechanics must be incomplete, using a scenario where measuring one particle of an entangled pair would seemingly reveal precise information about its distant partner, violating Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Einstein objected to what he called spooky actions at a distance, the idea that measuring one particle could instantaneously affect its distant partner, violating locality. This apparent violation of special relativity's speed limit deeply troubled Einstein until his death. Bell focused on a variation of the EPR experiment involving quantum spin, a discrete amount of angular momentum possessed by particles. Unlike macroscopic objects, quantum particles possess fixed amounts of spin, half units, whole units, etc., and can only be oriented in certain ways. A spin one-half particle, like an electron, can only be measured as up or down along any given direction, never in between. This quantization of spin had no classical analog and exemplified quantum mechanics' departure from classical physics. Bell realized this property could be used to test whether quantum entanglement required genuine non-locality. Bell's theorem, published in the obscure journal Physics Physique Physica in 1964, proved that no local hidden variable theory could reproduce all the predictions of quantum mechanics. Through careful mathematical analysis, he showed that any theory maintaining locality must satisfy certain statistical inequalities, now called Bell inequalities, that quantum mechanics violates. In other words, either quantum mechanics was wrong, or the world was fundamentally non-local, particles could indeed influence each other instantaneously across any distance. This result went beyond previous philosophical arguments to provide a concrete experimental test. Despite its profound implications, Bell's paper initially went unnoticed. For 4 years, it received no citations whatsoever. Citations began appearing slowly, just 6 in 1971, 7 in 1972, 3 in 1973, before activity increased around 1976. The largest share of early papers on Bell's theorem came from the United States, with nearly 3/4 of these produced by participants in Berkeley's Fundamental Physics Group, who had devoted their earliest sessions to Bell's work and quantum non-locality. The group recognized that Bell's theorem forced a choice between quantum mechanics and fundamental principles like locality and realism that most physicists took for granted. Subsequent experimental tests, particularly those by Alain Aspect in the early 1980s, would confirm quantum mechanics predictions and establish non-locality as a basic feature of nature, though the implications remain debated today. The Fundamental Physics Group members followed diverse paths to Bell's theorem. Most were part of the Sputnik generation, drawn to physics' big metaphysical questions, but finding their education crushingly pragmatic. Many graduated just as physics employment collapsed, disrupting their expected careers. John Clauser discovered Bell's paper while browsing through Physics Physique Physica as a Columbia graduate student in 1967. Though excited about testing Bell's theorem experimentally, his thesis advisor rebuffed him, and he was subsequently kicked out of prestigious offices, from Robert Serber's to Richard Feynman's. Despite employment challenges in the collapsing physics job market, Clauser secured a postdoctoral position at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory through Charles Townes, who allowed him to devote half his time to experimental tests of Bell's theorem. Clauser built his apparatus from scavenged parts, dumpster diving around the lab. In 1972, he published the first experimental results testing Bell's theorem, confirming quantum mechanics rather than toppling it as he'd privately hoped. His experiment demonstrated that measurements of particle A were indeed more strongly correlated with particle B than local mechanisms could explain, precisely the spooky action at a distance Einstein had found troubling. Yet despite publishing in physical review letters, few physicists seemed interested. Elizabeth Rauscher was among the few who recognized the significance of Clauser's experiments. A Berkeley physics graduate student with an unconventional approach, Rauscher had been fascinated by science since childhood. As one of the rare women in physics, women earned only 5% of undergraduate physics degrees and 2% of PhDs nationally, she faced considerable obstacles, including anonymous threats and sabotaged lab work. Undeterred, she founded discussion groups and taught summer courses examining the relationship between science and society. Other key members included Saul Paul Sirag, a physics dropout born to missionaries in Dutch Borneo who had abandoned his Berkeley studies for theater, becoming part of the counterculture scene. Nick Herbert, who had studied engineering physics at Ohio State before earning a Stanford physics PhD in 1967. And Henry Stapp, a senior Berkeley physicist who had studied with European quantum pioneers. By May 1975, when Elizabeth Rauscher secured a weekly reservation for the former office of Ernest O. Lawrence at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, the Fundamental Physics Group was born. Each Friday afternoon, the room would fill with physicists seeking to explore quantum reality and its implications. But their interests extended beyond Bell's theorem and non-locality to include parapsychological or psi phenomena like extrasensory perception and psychokinesis, which many members believed could be explained by quantum non-locality. Princeton Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner had proposed a decade earlier that consciousness plays a central role in quantum mechanics. Wigner suggested consciousness was the only thing that could break the infinite regress of probabilities in quantum measurements, introducing his famous Wigner's Friend thought experiment to demonstrate that consciousness must have a different role in quantum mechanics than the inanimate measuring device. John Wheeler developed similar ideas, advocating for what he called the participatory universe, arguing that observers actively participate in creating the reality they measure. Wheeler extended this concept with his delayed choice experiments, proposing that observers could retroactively determine a particle's past behavior by choosing which measurement to perform after the particle had already completed most of its journey. Jack Sarfatti aimed to connect these ideas with psi phenomena. If quantum objects were interconnected via entanglement, Bell's theorem, and consciousness shaped quantum processes, Wigner-Wheeler, then physics might explain psi phenomena. Sarfatti argued that while most mental contributions to quantum particles would be uncoordinated and incoherent, certain individuals might possess volitional control over quantum motions. Nick Herbert created a bizarre device called the metaphase typewriter to test these theories. This contraption used radioactive thallium, a Geiger counter, and a teletype machine to convert the random time delays between radioactive decays into letters. If consciousness could influence quantum events, then minds, either living or disembodied, might be able to manipulate these quantum probabilities to produce coherent messages through the machine. As the fundamental physics group ventured into controversial territory, they needed both intellectual freedom and financial support outside traditional academic channels. With universities suffering budget cuts and job losses, they had to secure funding from unconventional sources and create their own parallel institutions. Arthur Young, a Princeton-educated engineer who had invented the first commercially licensed helicopter, became an early patron. Jarred by the atomic bombings and financially secure from his helicopter patents, Young turned to philosophy, Jungian psychoanalysis, and Eastern spirituality. In 1973, he opened the Institute for the Study of Consciousness in Berkeley, believing science could best serve mankind by merging quantum theory with psychology and ESP. When some group members grew restless under Young's intellectual constraints, toy manufacturer Henry Dakin stepped in, offering his San Francisco house for the consciousness theory group's meetings. The expanded group now included computer programmers, EEG specialists, a biophysicist studying psychic healing of bacteria, and electronic music pioneer Charles McDermid. Werner Erhard emerged as perhaps their most significant patron. After Wolf and Sarfatti met him at the Ritz Hotel in Paris in 1974, Erhard, who had named himself after Werner Heisenberg and whose EST seminars had already earned millions, provided funding for their Physics Consciousness Research Group, PCRG. Despite controversy surrounding EST's confrontational methods, Erhard's lifelong fascination with physics made him eager to support cutting-edge research. In January 1976, the various physics discussion groups converged at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur for the first annual workshop on physics and consciousness. Founded in 1962 by Michael Murphy, Esalen had become the epicenter of the New Age movement, hosting workshops on Gestalt therapy, transpersonal psychology, and Eastern mysticism. Nick Herbert and Saul-Paul Sarad organized annual 5-day workshops on Bell's theorem and the nature of reality, which ran until 1988, the longest-running seminar series in Esalen's mystery. These intense sessions featured heated debates about quantum reality amidst dramatic weather, with regular participants including John Clauser, Henry Stapp, and David Finkelstein. Even Richard Feynman, who initially declined, later hosted his own Esalen workshop in 1983. Members of the Fundamental Physics Group pioneered a new genre of popular physics books in the 1970s that connected quantum physics concepts with Eastern mysticism and New Age ideas. These works functioned both as popular science books and as alternative textbooks for science students, with Fritjof Capra's The Tao of Physics, 1975, becoming the most successful example of this hybrid approach. Despite criticisms from some academics, many physicists embraced Capra's work as a way to improve physics' public image during a time of widespread anti-scientific sentiment. The Cornell astrophysicist reviewing the book for Physics Today praised it for integrating the abstract, rational worldview of science with the immediate, feeling-oriented vision of the mystic. Physics educators quickly incorporated the book into their curricula, with the American Journal of Physics publishing articles on how to use it effectively in classrooms. David Harrison at the University of Toronto developed a popular Zen of Physics course using Capra's approach, attracting both physics majors and non-science students. His course included novel assignments like having students distinguish between quotes from physicists versus mystics. Through correspondence with Nick Herbert of the Fundamental Physics Group, Harrison incorporated Bell's theorem into his teaching long before it appeared in standard textbooks. The Fundamental Physics Group's exploration of quantum entanglement in relation to parapsychology and Eastern mysticism placed them outside mainstream physics, yet no clear boundaries separated them from real physics. Many established physicists engaged seriously with the group's ideas. John Bell himself, when asked about connections between parapsychology and quantum entanglement, refused to dismiss the possibility outright, comparing the difficulty in reproducing psi effects to his own student struggles reproducing electrostatic experiments in damp Northern Ireland. Several eminent physicists engaged seriously with parapsychology and quantum connections. Yale's Henri Marginau likened psi research to early radioactivity studies. Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner publicly supported Elizabeth Rauscher's quantum explanations for remote viewing. Perhaps most notably, Brian Josephson, who won the Nobel Prize at age 33 for discovering the Josephson junction, embraced Eastern mysticism and parapsychology shortly afterward. Nick Herbert had been intrigued by the practical applications of Bell's theorem in quantum entanglement from his earliest encounters with the concepts. In his 1975 re-derivation of Bell's theorem, he speculated about the possibility of superluminal telegraphy, using entangled particles to send messages faster than light. The implications of faster-than-light communication were profound and paradoxical. Messages could be received before being sent, creating causal loopholes like warning ancestors about stock market crashes or altering past events. Some even wondered if phenomena like telepathy might already represent such signaling. In May 1978, Jack Sarfati prepared a patent disclosure for a faster-than-light quantum communication system that he circulated through his network. His device used entangled photons sent to distant detectors, with the transmitter manipulating the efficiency of a slit detector to encode messages that would instantly appear as variations in interference patterns at the receiver's end. Within a year, Nick Herbert devised a design called FLASH, First Laser Amplified Superluminal Hookup. Herbert's scheme exploited the coherent nature of laser light. The amplified output would maintain the same polarization as the input. In his design, experimenter A would measure either linear or circular polarization of one photon, forcing its twin, heading to experimenter B, into a corresponding state. This photon would enter the laser gain tube, producing numerous identical copies. Herbert's FLASH paper received wildly divergent reviews from six referees, with several prominent physicists unable to find any flaws in the scheme. Even Richard Feynman had been stumped, until Wojciech Zurek personally explained what became known as the no-cloning theorem, the impossibility of making perfect copies of unknown quantum states. While the debate over superluminal communication continued, a parallel development began to emerge, quantum encryption. What had seemed like a limitation of quantum theory, the inability to clone quantum states, was transformed into an asset for secure communication. The concept of quantum encryption began with Stephen Wisner's ingenious quantum money scheme. His system involved embedding photons with specific polarization states inside dollar bills, with the issuing bank maintaining a sealed record of these states. Any counterfeiter attempting to copy the bill would need to measure the photon's polarizations, but quantum mechanics ensured they could never determine the correct states with certainty, making perfect counterfeiting physically impossible. In December 1984, Charles Bennett and Gilles Brassard presented the landmark BB84 protocol for quantum key distribution. Like Herbert's FLASH scheme, BB84 uses photon polarization states, but with a crucial difference. After measurements, communicating parties compare only which detector settings they used, not measurement outcomes. For matching detector settings, they could infer perfectly correlated results, creating a shared secret key. This system has moved beyond theory to real-world applications, including a 2004 bank transfer in Vienna and 2007 electronic voting in Geneva. Researchers have demonstrated quantum encryption through fiber optic cables up to 115 miles long and through open air for nearly 100 miles, sufficient for satellite communication. The Fundamental Physics Group disbanded in early 1979 after nearly 4 years of weekly meetings. Elizabeth Rauscher and George Weissman, the group's founders, had completed their dissertations and moved on to other commitments. Internal tensions also contributed to the group's dissolution, with personal rivalries intensifying as some members achieved publishing success. The members followed diverse paths after the group disbanded. Jack Sarfati, after a period of financial struggle, connected with conservative patrons and transformed his politics. Saul Paul Sarag took a job as a night watchman at an upscale San Francisco apartment building, a position perfectly suited to his scholarly nature. During quiet night shifts, he studied physics and wrote research papers, publishing 2 articles in the prestigious journal Nature. Nick Herbert's Quantum Reality, 1985, filled an important niche, explaining Bell's theorem and quantum entanglement when no textbooks covered these topics. The book sold over 100,000 copies, earned translations in German and Japanese, and remains in print decades later. Elizabeth Rauscher founded Technic Research Laboratories, securing contracts from the Naval Surface Weapons Center and aerospace manufacturer Martin Marietta for the Space Shuttle program. In the late 1990s, Elizabeth Rauscher and George Weissman organized a 25th anniversary reunion of the Fundamental Physics Group, held on November 18, 2000. Henry Dakin hosted the event in San Francisco, bringing together core members including John Clauser, Nick Herbert, Jack Sarfati, Fred Allen Wolf, Saul Paul Sarag, Fritjof Capra, and Russell Targ. The Fundamental Physics Group's influence extended into physics education as the discipline underwent major shifts. As graduate enrollments plummeted in the 1970s, faculty could incorporate broader pedagogical approaches. Essay questions requiring conceptual articulation rather than just calculations reappeared on doctoral exams. New quantum mechanics textbooks emerged with interpretive discussion questions. Following physics' second post-Cold War collapse in the 1990s, new institutions emerged to sustain foundational research outside mainstream funding structures. The Perimeter Institute, founded in 1999, supports foundational, non-directed research with a youth-oriented focus and flattest possible hierarchy, echoing countercultural values. The web-based Foundational Questions Institute, FQXI, distributes modest grants for deep foundational questions unlikely to be supported by conventional funding sources. While occasional boundary disputes still erupt, many fundamental physics group interests have entered the mainstream. Leading physicists now explore consciousness and quantum brain processes, building on work by group member Henry Stapp. When our children eventually use quantum encrypted messages and quantum computers, they'll be living in a world that these hippie physicists helped invent, a world where the deepest questions about reality have returned to the heart of physics.